the record of the Biden-Harris administration was terrible. It was terrible on the economy. It was terrible on the cost of living. It was terrible on the border. You had fiascos like the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan. And they didn't even try to run on that record. They knew it was bad. They didn't even attempt to defend it. So the first problem is they're running for re-election and they don't have a record to run on. And the second fundamental problem is that Kamala Harris was a lousy candidate. And again, this is not a big surprise. She ran for president in 2020. She never got a vote.
Welcome to another episode of Counterculture, the show that stands at the intersection of reason and faith in the battle against sentimentality. As I argued on this podcast for weeks, the combination of the crosstabs in the polling and the distribution of early voting, seeming to confirm the polling was directionally correct, it looked like Trump was headed for the electoral landslide that indeed came to be. In between the weeping and the shrieking, the most prominent voices on the left are offering one of three explanations. Number one, it was all Biden's fault, and Kamala did the best she could under the circumstances. Number two, as former White House spokeshuman Jen Psaki said, everything just somehow broke Trump's way, and he is just, I'm quoting, an incredibly lucky bastard. Or number three, by far the most popular offering, the majority of Americans are afflicted by various phobias and burdened by myriad isms, as, for example, the views Sunny Hostin explained.
I'm surprised at the result, but I'm not surprised. As a woman of color, I was so hopeful that a mixed race woman married to a Jewish guy could be elected president of this country. Uh-huh. And I think that it had nothing to do with policy. I think this was a referendum of cultural resentment in this country.
Well,
MSNBC's Joe Scarborough took it a step further, adding heightism to the usual suspects of racism and transphobia.
If she were a 6'4" white man from Arkansas or from, you know, Florida, and she ran a good middle of the road campaign talking about reaching out, do you think she would be losing by that much?
If she
could like chew tobacco and carry a shotgun and talk about football and be a guy's guy, I mean, you tell me.
What Hostin, Scarborough and the other leftist professional pontificators know for sure is that the GOP sweep had nothing to do with Kamala and the policies of the Biden-Harris administration. Knee-jerk identitarianism, not thoughtful reflection, is the order of the day because, by all indications, the left remains a revolutionary movement. For Trump, Tuesday marked a restart of the counter-revolution begun in 2016. Trump and Republicans have the federal government and a majority of the governors and state legislatures. The new Bolsheviks retain control of Americans' civic and cultural institutions. So what now? It's a big question, and to help us think about how to answer it, we're pleased to be joined by John Hinderaker, president of the Center of the American Experiment and a contributor to the Powerline blog, which you find at powerlineblog.com. John, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you, Dan.
So let's start with your summation of what you think happened on Tuesday, why Trump and Republicans were able to take control of the presidency and the Congress.
Dan, I don't think it's hard to explain at all. The record of the Biden-Harris administration was terrible. It was terrible on the economy. It was terrible on the cost of living. It was terrible on the border. You had fiascos like the botched withdrawal from Afghanistan. And they didn't even try to run on that record. They knew it was bad. They didn't even attempt to defend it. So the first problem is they're running for re-election and they don't have a record to run on. And the second fundamental problem is that Kamala Harris was a lousy candidate. And again, this is not a big surprise. She ran for president in 2020. She never got a vote. She was out of the race before the Iowa caucuses. You know, the voters just didn't much like her. And so I don't think it's hard to explain why Trump won. I think the only thing the Democrats had going for them, thought they had going for them, was hatred of Donald Trump. And so they devoted the entire campaign to trying to stimulate hatred and fear of Donald Trump, because it was the only way that they thought they could win the election. And at the end of the day, a majority of American voters rejected that attempt. They liked Trump's policies. Some of them loved Trump. You know, Trump's a very popular guy in some quarters. But I think the reason why he had the record support from Latinos, for example, from Blacks, especially Black men, increasing support from Asian Americans, and record support from Jewish Americans, was his policies. These are people who suffered under the Biden-Harris administration, and they were looking for an alternative. And while Kamala Harris was talking about abortion and about, you know, joy or whatever that she was running on, Trump was talking about the issues. And so I don't think it's at all hard to explain why Trump won. I think the Democrats tried to implement what was inherently a long shot strategy, and they couldn't make it work.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting, too, because we've talked a lot about Trump's coalition and the improvements he made among Black and Latino voters, among Arab American voters in Michigan as well. But there was something else, too, that runs counter to the argument they're making now that, you know, the problem is she was a Black female and America's not ready for it. Typical argument, just like America wasn't ready for a female when Hillary Clinton was running. And so that's the only thing that could possibly explain her loss. But what happened actually when she entered the race and there was this enthusiasm is Donald Trump, his support among older voters and white voters shrank. And this is why she had developed a little bit of a lead in the early days. But then after about 5 or 6 weeks going into late October, that had reversed. So, you know, on the one hand, you hear the Sonny Hostins and the Joe Scarboroughs and all of the other mouthpieces talking about racism and sexism. But wait a second. Those same people that knew she was a Black female in early September when she got in, knew she was a Black female in late October when things started to move against her. And so there has to be something else that explains it. And it seems pretty obvious that what explains it is the lousy candidate part, is that, you know, turn the page, and then interview after interview, she can't answer the simple question, how would you have done anything differently than Biden? And how is a Kamala Harris presidency going to be any different than Biden? She didn't have an answer to the simplest of questions. That just is sort of basic. And I just think there's clearly a lot of willful blindness on the side of Kamala supporters and Trump haters that sort of overlooks that 6 week interregnum between her entrance and election day.
Dan, you make a great point. From the Democrat standpoint, of course, Kamala Harris was a DEI candidate. Their message in large part was vote for Kamala because she's a Black woman. So when people didn't vote for Kamala, they say, well, it must be because she was a Black woman, right? But the reality is that they simply can't seem to acknowledge is that the large majority of Americans didn't care that she was a Black woman. That's not what's important to them. They're not racist. They're not misogynist. They care about policies, and they care about how politicians' policies are going to impact their lives. And what they saw of Kamala Harris, it was not her race and sex. As you say, she started out fine, you know, when that was what they knew about her. But the more that Americans saw of Kamala Harris, the more they concluded that her policies, whatever they are, were not going to help them.
Well, the other thing, too, is going back to one of the other excuses, Biden, it's all Biden's fault. You know, the finger pointing is going on, as you would expect. So he's being scapegoated. But again, so what about the enablers, including Kamala Harris, that propagated this lie that he was exacting and probing and completely in command of his faculties and the administration right up until that June debate? So, I mean, it's, you know, they're sort of like the enablers of an alcoholic that keep feeding the alcoholic, you know, alcohol, and then come and say, you know, this guy's an alcoholic. I can't believe it. So that whole it's Biden's fault thing. So you wouldn't do anything different. You covered for him for all this time, and now it's all his fault that you lost.
Well, you know, the Democrats were in an impossible position. They ran the risk. They knew Biden was senile and incompetent and so forth. But they thought their best shot was to run him out there one more time. And then when he virtually collapsed on the stage in that presidential debate, and if you look at the betting odds, the betting odds went to like 75% Trump, they realized that they had to make a change. But that put them in this bizarre position where Kamala Harris is up there saying, turn the page, turn the page. Well, turn the page on what? On the administration where she served for 4 years as the vice president. It never made any sense. And so I think blaming Joe Biden in one sense is kind of silly. But on the other hand, blaming the fact that the Biden-Harris administration had a lousy record that she couldn't run on, but at the same time, she couldn't run against because she was the vice president. I mean, it was kind of a hopeless situation from the beginning, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that comes across is that the campaign was predicated on a fraud, the covering for Biden. And you know, in the entire presentation of it, in terms of what the value prop was, that was a fraud too. I mean, it's just, you know, we're not getting anything straight from this person. She is just, you know, every utterance is a prevarication of one form or another.
Well, that's exactly right. And to make it worse, somebody at Axios actually who referred to her as the no comment candidate, you know, time after time, she wouldn't even say what her position on an issue was. It was like it was a secret. And if there was any hope of her marking out an identity that was different from Joe Biden's, different from the failures of the Biden-Harris administration, she had to articulate positions that in some ways were going to be different, were going to be new. And she was either unable or unwilling to do that.
Well, and the great irony is, of course, you mentioned the betting markets after the June debate going to 75% for Trump. You know, by Tuesday, they were pretty close, some of them, to 75% for Trump too. I mean, this was not unforeseen, and they ended up sort of being hoist by their own petard, not just the covering for Biden, compounding the mistake by installing Kamala and then running the kind of campaign they did. I wonder if you think, you know, as some are saying, perhaps hopefully, that not Trump has dispatched all of these political dynasts of both parties, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Biden. They're all yesterday's news now.
Well, I think that's right. And fortunately, Trump is in a position where he's going to be able to get some things done. I think we're going to see a whirlwind of activity in the first 2 or 3 months of this administration. He's going to have a working majority in the House, I think. That's what everybody is predicting. He's going to have 53 or 54 votes in the Senate. All of his appointments are going to sail through. And I think we're going to see some very serious legislation coming in the first couple of months. And I think we're going to see some rapid action on things like immigration. Voters want to see the border closed. Well, there are things that Trump can do in his first week in office to move toward closing the border. And so I think we're going to see some very strong activity. And I think we're going to be in a situation where the Democrats are not going to be able to block most of what Trump and the Republicans want to do. And so we'll see what happens. I think most voters are going to like what they see. I think most voters are going to like the consequences of the policies the Republicans are going to put into effect. And we'll see what happens.
On the issue of what they will call retribution, what you or I might call accountability, what do you think Trump's posture should be going with respect to the Jack Smiths of the world, let's be specific, with respect to Jack Smith and Alvin Bragg and Judge Merchan in the Manhattan business records case, and Letitia James and Judge Ergeron in the Trump Organization case, and Fannie Willis and the IRS and the FBI per the IRS investigation of Hunter Biden and what the whistleblowers, IRS whistleblowers have said. How should Trump deal with that? Does he just move quickly to get an attorney general in charge and leave that person to his own devices, sort of knowing what they will do, wash his hands of it and focus on the border and focus on Elon Musk's efficiency commission and so forth to reduce federal spending? You know, what's your recommendation or feel for how he's going to sort of manage these competing interests that all have to be dealt with essentially simultaneously?
I think he should move on. It's already being reported that Jack Smith is going to go out of business, that he's going to dismiss those two absurd criminal prosecutions, which are on life support anyway. There isn't really much that Trump can do about state prosecutions. And I don't think there's much that he should do. There are news reports that the judge, I forget his name, that presided over the ridiculous, you know, Stormy Daniels prosecution. He's the guy that, in my opinion, should go to prison. Well, Alvin Bragg, you know, the DA that brought it. I mean, if there was real accountability, Alvin Bragg ought to be wearing an orange jumpsuit, you know, in my view. But Trump can't really make those things happen. And I think that those DAs, law enforcement people, are going to be backing off. They can't do anything while Trump is in office. You know, 4 years are going to go by. He'll be 82 years old. There's going to be no appetite to try to resurrect those cases in 4 years. But I do think where federal agencies are involved, I mean, Trump needs to reform the leadership of the FBI and the CIA and the IRS, and he should make no bones about that. You know, he should appoint a new FBI director. He should appoint an attorney general, obviously. He should appoint a new CIA director, and they should have a clear mandate to clean up the leadership of those agencies. I don't think there's a big problem with the rank and file agents of the FBI or the rank and file agents in the CIA, but there's a huge problem in the leadership of both of those agencies, and Trump has got to clean it up.
And with respect to some of the personnel you'd like to see around Trump, because this is going to be the leading indicator that Trump has, as has been sort of suggested, that he's learned the lessons. He suggested himself some of the appointments I made weren't so good. That's about as much of an admission of a mistake as you'll get from Trump. And so I wonder when you're talking about these sensitive positions, attorney general, FBI director, CIA director, DHS, Homeland Security director, you know, who are the types of people, Secretary of State, who are the types of people you're looking for that, you know, some of whom are being rumored right now, to indicate that Trump really has learned the lessons and this is going to be, you know, basically an ass-kicking administration when it comes to the way things have always been done in Washington?
Well, I have not seen extensive lists of names. I've seen some, and the lists that I've seen have been very good. You know, we'll see who he actually appoints, but I like the fact that he surrounded himself with people like Elon Musk and Tulsi Gabbard, you know, and some of the others. I'm not so crazy about RFK Jr., but in general, I think he surrounded himself with very good, very strong people from different elements of the Republican Party, not always from the Republican Party at all. And you know, we'll have to see who he picks for some of these positions. For example, I've heard no speculation at all about FBI director. Have you?
Not much. No, it's been, you know, it's I've heard Rubio for Secretary of State and people like Mike Lee for AG, John Ratcliffe for AG. But FBI director, it has been sort of quiet who that person may be. I'm in complete agreement. I mean, Christopher Wray has to be one of those gone day one. Don't make the same mistake you made with Comey.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I'm a huge fan of Marco Rubio. I'd love to see him as Secretary of State. I also love to see him in the Senate. And so I have mixed feelings about pulling people out of those important positions to put them into the administration. Tom Cotton, who's a friend of mine, I notice has publicly said that he's not looking for a position in the administration. I know some people have speculated about Tom as a possible CIA director. I think there are people inside the CIA who would love to see that. But I think he's taken himself out of that contention and wants to stay in the Senate instead. So we'll see a sorting out over the next month or two of where people come to rest. But the big difference, I think, Dan, is that this time around, Trump is really prepared. When he won in 2016, I don't think he expected to win. He did not have a good transition in place. He did not have a lot of ideas about nominations. What he did know was that he didn't want to do what usually happens, that is recycle all the old Bush people, right? That would be the normal thing, is you'd staff your administration with the leftovers from the last Republican or the last Democratic administration. He didn't want to do that. And of course, not having been a lifetime politician, he didn't have a big band of followers, you know, ready to plug into these positions. I think the second time around, he's much better prepared. He expected to win. He understands what it takes to staff an administration. He just knows a lot more people now. And I think we are going to be pleasantly surprised. I think we're going to like what we see as he fills out the administration.
Well, one of the lessons learned from the first term is, you know, he didn't want to do the Bush holdovers. The Bush holdovers, you didn't have to bring them in. They were already there. You know, they never left. I mean, that was part of the problem, an understanding of the layers of bureaucracy and connections that persist regardless of who's present. And I think, you know, it seems to me, and Howard Lutnick, from Cantor Fitzgerald, who's chaired his transition team, seems to understand that, too. No corporate lobbyists are on the transition team. You know, he's bringing people that either share or are gaining his understanding of how you have to look at these federal agencies almost like layer by layer, and perhaps, and I hope, conceiving about how to greatly reduce the footprint of most of those agencies.
Well, Dan, one of the big problems that Republican presidents have is that while theoretically they run the executive branch, constitutionally they are the executive branch. The reality is that they can only appoint, what is it, the first three levels of every cabinet department, every agency, and everything below that is civil service. What that means realistically, and did you see, by the way, I think District of Columbia voted, 92%, 93% right, for Kamala Harris. This is enemy territory. And so realistically, these agencies are staffed by liberal Democrats. That's the vast majority of the civil service component of the body of all of these agencies. And so for a Republican president to actually be able to run the executive branch is a big challenge. And it's not one that I'm sure any recent Republican president has really managed to overcome. So for example, how does Donald Trump really get his policies implemented by the Environmental Protection Agency when every member of that agency below the high level of his appointees is aligned in the opposite direction? The Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, by rights, they ought to just fire the entire division, right? They ought to just clean house and start over from scratch, but he can't do that. He can only replace the top levels of the bureaucracy. So I think one of the things that will play out kind of beneath the surface over the next 4 years of the Trump administration is this internal warfare against the bureaucrats, against the deep state, you know, call it what you will. Is Trump really going to be able to get the policies out of the executive branch that he wants?
Right. I mean, the Chevron decision last term from the Supreme Court helps in terms of defanging some of these agencies operating sort of independently of any accountability. That's number one. Number two, one of the tests, it seems to me, will be if he and Musk or whoever else can figure a way to just reduce the size of the agencies by reducing headcount. I mean, do essentially what Musk did at Twitter, is do a reduction in force of 20, 30, 40% across the board in particular agencies, or maybe synchronize it so it doesn't become, you know, something you have to spend a ton of political capital on. And that's one of the other questions, too. I mean, these are the judgment calls he has to make, is where do I want to spend political capital, knowing that everything I do is going to come with the hysteria of the left, right? So I can't let that drive my decision making. But all these appointments we're talking about and the policies that need to be advanced post haste, like border security. But at the same time, he's made promises about, for example, January 6th, people convicted of crimes on January 6th, nonviolent crimes that are serving prison time. He's basically called them political prisoners, basically set them in a commute of their sentences at minimum, if not pardon them. You know, is that something you do out of the gate too and risk getting sidetracked? I mean, I think it's the right thing to do because these people are in jail and they shouldn't be, but you know, there's a political cost to pay to do that when you're also trying to do a mass deportation and you're trying to extend the tax cuts and you're trying to reduce the size of government.
Well, Dan, I agree with you that a lot of the J6 protesters don't belong in jail. A lot of them were held in jail for a long time before trial. How'd that happen? You know, but I would not make that an early priority. The Democrats have made hay out of the January 6th protest for going on 4 years now. They've given it way more attention than it deserves. I keep asking, when are people going to be upset about the fact that the Democrats occupied the state capital of Wisconsin for 6 months. We hear all this nonsense about the sacred capital and the attack on the capital. The Democrats literally occupied the capital of Wisconsin for 6 months. And as far as I could tell, they paid zero political price. But I think that for political reasons, he should let that one go early in his administration. At some point, I don't think it's a pardon. I think it's a commutation, or maybe a very selective pardon, you know. But I don't think he should prioritize that, because I do think that that feeds the flames without any real payoff for him politically.
Because of the nature of the victory, you know, the electoral landslide, and bringing, helping to bring some senators across the finish line too, in addition to House members, and just the popular revolt that his reelection represents. I mean, do you see him having problems in his own party the way that he had when he took office in 2017, including with the speaker at the time, Paul Ryan, which is why they couldn't move and didn't move as fast on border security as they otherwise could have? I mean, do you see any stumbling blocks for him? I mean, not the one-off, one or two-off senator like Collins or Murkowski, but like a leadership problem with whoever the Senate Majority Leader is, or any problems with leadership in the House?
I see no problems at all. The Republican Party has been transformed. Obviously, we got Mike Johnson in the House. I think he's doing a terrific job, 100% aligned with Trump. I think John Thune is probably going to be the majority leader in the Senate. Thune is a very conservative guy. He predates Trump. You don't think of him as a big Trump acolyte, certainly, but he's going to be completely aligned, I think, with the policy agenda. And I think they're going to have at least 53 votes. They might have 54. So the Lisa Murkowski, you know, is not going to be able to demand to get her way at critical points. I'm very optimistic, Dan. I mean, knock on wood, I've been wrong before, but I'm very optimistic that we are going to see a coordinated approach, that the Trump administration, the Republican House, the Republican Senate are going to be closely aligned. They're going to understand the importance of getting important and popular things done in the first 90 days. I think we're going to see some really productive activity in Washington, and I think the voters are going to like it.
What do you expect from the other side? I mean, we started talking about the excuses that they're making. I mean, they continue to sort of alternatively patronize Americans or excoriate them. That's the only way they seem to know how to interact with other human beings. They're either pandering to you, or they're telling you how disappointing you are to them. But some people have suggested, well, this is going to be, harkening back to the Bush years. After 88, this is going to be like a DLC redux, right, that brought Clinton to the fore. You're going to have to find whatever moderates exist in that party, and you're going to have to put them forward. You're going to have to sort of represent your brand and your case to the American people. And that's an easy thing to say, but you look around that party, old guard, new guard, and you just don't see who those voices exactly are, and how you would move where the critical mass is, which is Bolshevikism, how you just move these people out of the way, particularly when they're out continuing to prosecute the identitarian case, as you've heard the last 48 hours.
Dan, the Democratic Party has a huge identity problem. They've got to decide, what does it mean to be a Democrat? And in recent years, the predominant answer has been neo-Marxism. It's been a Marxism based on racial and sexual identity as opposed to class identity. And it's failed. DEI is unpopular with the American people. The American people believe in merit. They don't like race discrimination. They don't like sex discrimination. That neo-Marxist approach is unpopular. It is not going to succeed. Well, if you put that to the side, what else does the Democratic Party stand for? Well, it stands for abortion. And that's almost the only issue that in the last two cycles, the Democrats have really wanted to talk about. There's a reason why Kamala Harris couldn't answer simple questions about what is your position on issue X, issue Y, issue Z. The Democrats are kind of left without a clear policy agenda. Socialism, they got a socialist wing, AOC, and some of these people will admit the Democratic Socialists of America. Socialism has failed and been repudiated all across the world. And as the Democrats have evolved toward being an upper class party instead of a working class party, or, you know, traditional socialism has got zero appeal, right? And so what exactly does the Democratic Party stand for? At the moment, it basically stands for two things. Number one, abortion. And number two, not being Republicans, right? And so their campaign in 2024 basically was all about trying to stimulate hatred of Republicans. Republicans are fascists, you know, they're Hitler, you know, they're dictators. Well, that's ridiculous. You know, these false accusations are not the substance of a major political party. So I think the Democrats are in a very tough corner, and they've got to come up with a way to define a new identity, which is not neo-Marxist, which is not merely identitarian. And to the extent that there are populist economic themes that they could seize on, Trump has kind of beaten them to those themes, right? I really am not sure where the Democrats go at this point.
It'll be really interesting to see if you have some aspirant to the White House on the Democrat side, you know, some governor or big city mayor, maybe Eric Adams. Although, I mean, not that he's necessarily aspirant to the White House when he's under indictment at present, but somewhere somebody's going to say, you know what, I need to break from even perhaps the positions I've held up until this point, the way that Kamala did out of necessity. And they're going to say, we need to end our sanctuary city designation or our sanctuary state designation, because I need to find some room here to separate myself from the gaggle. And this is where the market opportunity lies. I mean, you know, or maybe something with on trans, like men and girls sports. But it just seems there's this open space for some Democrat to occupy if they have the political courage to suffer the slings and arrows of their base.
Well, we've seen some of that, Dan. We've seen it especially on crime. Right. In California, they passed the new proposition that basically repeals the old proposition. And politicians like Gavin Newsom are now saying, yeah, we have to arrest criminals after all. And they're all denying that they ever supported the defund the police movement. Right. So we've seen that kind of walking back on crime. But that is probably necessary for the Democrats, but it certainly is not enough. They're never going to be more pro-law enforcement than the Republicans, right?
Right.
And it's the same thing with immigration. They are never going to be defined as the anti-illegal immigration party. And they really can't come out and say, you know what, the Republicans were right all along on crime, or the Republicans were right all along on illegal immigration. These are going to be more sort of quiet walkbacks. But I don't see how they can ever become really the definition of the Democratic Party.
Or they have to find a way to get some sort of compromise legislation that they can live with and be a part of, that Republicans may initiate, right? And so they say, look, we're you know, being constructive, and we're not the open borders crazies that you think we are or that we used to be, however you want to describe it. They need some sort of cover story to cover their retreat. But I mean, I don't see how they make this. They continue to make the same play they've made for the last 8 years. In part because Trump will be leaving the scene, so they got to come up with somebody else other than Trump, and there's no singular person that they've done anything near what they've done to Trump in terms of the huge bet they made on the demonization of him. So it just seems like even though the races were relatively close despite the sweep, it just seems like they're far afield.
I think that ideological confusion, you don't immediately pay a price for ideological confusion. You know, there are a lot of factors, a lot of moving parts, a lot of historic attachment that people have to parties and so on. But over time, I think you pay a huge price for ideological confusion. And I think that the ideological clarity that Ronald Reagan, for example, brought to the Republican Party fueled the Republican Party for the next, 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
And I think that the ideological, not totally different, but somewhat different ideological core that Donald Trump has brought to the Republican Party is going to fuel the Republican Party for quite a few years to come. I think at the moment, the Democrats don't really have an ideological core that is solid and that they can run on, not just today, but for cycles to come. And but to go back to your point about what do they call it, the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council,
right,
that got behind Bill Clinton and so forth. I agree with you. I don't see that moderate element anywhere in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I mean, right. You think about people in high profile positions, governors and senators, and you know they've all been in lockstep with this. I mean, I maybe there's some relatively new faces like a Wes Moore in Maryland, black gentleman, military experience, under 50. If he doesn't, you know, completely behave like a Maryland Democrat, maybe somebody like that could emerge. But you know, you always want to have an understanding of the landscape and what your political opponents are doing. And what they're doing right now is completely melting down before us.
There's a related problem they have too, Dan, which is the predictions they've made and the characterizations they've made, right? Donald Trump, he's going to set up internment camps, right? As
right.
if the president had the power to do that. I mean, it's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. The governor of New York, Trump is a fascist. He's a Nazi. He's a Hitler. Well, you know, it's going to be blindingly obvious over the coming 4 years that Trump is not a Nazi. He's not a Hitler. There are no internment camps. He's not arresting journalists. I mean,
right.
all these things.
2024 is not going to be our last election.
No, right.
So, right.
Exactly. So they're going to be sitting there with egg on their face, looking really stupid. Well, at the same time, in substantive policy terms, their cupboard is really empty, you know, other than yammering endlessly about abortion, what have they got? I think they are facing a real problem.
What do you think about the DC press corps? Their comm shop, basically, because you read the responses from the Gang of 500, the New York Times, and the Amazon Post, and just like MSNBC, CNN. I mean, the responses, it's like they cut and pasted the responses they had to Trump's victory in 2016 and are reusing them in 2024.
Well, one of the things that we've seen this year, it's a process. It's been going on for the last 20 years, the diminution in power of what used to be called the mainstream media. I don't call them that anymore. We've had a total fragmentation of information sources, of media sources. And I think one of the takeaways from this election is that the power of the liberal, what I call the Democratic Party media, whether it's the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, the Associated Press, CBS News, NBC News, the power is gone. And the reason the power is gone is that no one takes them seriously anymore as arbiters. No one thinks that they are neutral and objective. No one thinks they have superior expertise. No one thinks that they have got some kind of authority, right? They are viewed as what they are, advocates for the Democratic Party and for liberalism, and they're treated as such. And so I think one of the great things that we saw in this election, but again, it's building on something that's been going on for a long time. And you may remember, Dan, back in 2004, my website got kind of famous because of the role that we played with respect to exposing 60 Minutes and CBS News for the lies they were propagating about then President George W. Bush. And that was one of the seminal events 20 years ago that really led to the eroding of respect for what at that time was still regarded as an important institution, you know, the mainstream media. Well, now Donald Trump can go on the Joe Rogan podcast and actually have a conversation for 3 hours where they really talk about things. And it turns out that is a lot more effective than the 15-second sentence fragment snippets that they want to put on CNN to make Trump look bad. So I think this is another area where the Democrats are just facing a major, major problem. The capital that those press institutions once had has all been spent. That capital is all gone.
Before I let you go, I know you're up in Minnesota, so Tuesday night was a twofer for you. You got President Trump and Republicans, but you're fortunate now that Tim Walz will return and be your governor. So you've got that good news coming your way. Tim Walz, what you know, as somebody who knows him intimately, because you're up there and you pay attention to these things locally as well. Were you surprised how Tim Walz performed on the trail? In retrospect, do you think Kamala regrets that pick?
I have no idea what she thinks in retrospect. She should regret it. I was a little bit surprised. I mean, my organization has been following Walz closely for 6 years now, almost 6 years, writing extensively about his policies, his actions. And it was really interesting to see how the Minnesota press is unbelievably quiescent. I mean, it's like the national press, only worse, only more so. And it was interesting to see how when Tim Walz got in the glare of the national spotlight, some things started getting attention that had not gotten much attention in the years he's been in politics here in Minnesota. Things like his military record, but other things as well. And some of the policy failures that my organization has been writing about for years started getting national attention, which they had not gotten in the past. You know, Minnesota is one of the states that people are leaving. It's like California. It's like your state of Illinois. It's like New York. People are not moving into Minnesota. They're moving out of Minnesota. And it's for the same reasons that they're moving out of California and Illinois and New York. Our taxes are too high. Our economy is moribund. Our regulatory regime is unproductive. And instead of trying to make this a better state, our government is going down the DEI route. It's going down the gender, you know, route. And
Tampon Tim.
And Tim Walz is going to, you know, after that performance in the vice presidential debate, I mean, it was terrible. There were moments in the first half hour of that debate when I was seriously starting to wonder whether Tim Walz might flee the stage. I mean, he was absolutely terrified. And he's going to return to Minnesota a wounded politician. There had been talk about him running for a third term. My guess is, which you can do in Minnesota, my guess is that's going to be off the table. I think he's going to serve out the 2 years he has remaining on this term, and he's going to be departing the scene.
Well, maybe Tim and Gretchen and Kamala and Doug can spend some quality time at Lake Wobegon in their political retirement. And John Hindraker, he is the president of the Center of the American Experiment, contributor of Powerline Blog, powerlineblog.com. John, thank you as always for your time and insights. Appreciate it. Good talking with you.
Great to be with you, Dan.
Please like this video and subscribe to this channel if you haven't already. And please leave a comment in the comment section. We'd love to hear your thoughts.